Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, an hour on the arts where we'll delve into film screenings with a new slant, discover the psyche and art of ancient Persia, talk to a prize-winning local author and sample some new contemporary choral music. In this edition, Cambridge filmmaking consortium NERF turns the City House inside out and shows off its latest celluloid creations. We investigate the art of Shahnameh, the ancient Persian Book of Kings, at a contemporary music and dance performance. Director of the Konkan Nenda Choir, Alexandra Schwinn, launches a new album and previews a contemporary choral music concert. Cambridge artist Gail de Cordova previews her new exhibition at Clare College Gallery. And Askance Publishing releases a new anthology of short stories from finalists of an international writing competition. Imagine turning over the secrets of your Cambridge home to a group of filmmaking artists, who then set about creating a short film inspired by interpreting the contents of each room, and then go on to show the film in that same room to a group of browsing guests. Sounds a bit outlandish, but the results of Cambridge-based experimental film collaboration NERF Film Consortium are quite remarkable. The group of nine artists was founded 7 years ago with the help of the Arts Picture House, Kettle's Yard and the Cambridge Film Consortium, and won funding from the Arts Council, as well as a helping hand from Anglia Ruskin University. Artist Anna Cady introduces the NERF at Home event.
Kettle's Yard and Cambridge Film Consortium all put together a series of workshops that we could all, as artists, learn how to make film and use Final Cut. And we had a series of lectures and series of workshops, and then we've stayed together ever since, about 7 years it is now.
It started off as nine artists, and you weren't all filmmakers, were you, in the first place?
No, we were all artists who were invited to learn about films, and we all were all desperate to use film. It was part of what we needed to do next.
Now, you're all doing very, very different things, aren't you? Mm-hmm. So how does the group dynamic work between you?
Well, sometimes it's quite challenging because I think, crikey, when somebody says, let's do this, and I think, oh, no, I really don't want to do that. Mm. But actually, you just have to take what the group suggests and run with it.
Yeah. Can we talk about some of the things that you're exhibiting here? Obviously, there's lots of things we can hear in the background because there's a screen in the garden, there's a screen in every different room in the house, and lots of people enjoying the films and milling around. But what we've got in the front room, there seems to be a film about families and people's inner worlds. What's that about?
Well, you're quite right, it is about that. But in fact, what we've all tried to do is respond in some way to the house, to our relationship to Ernie, whose house it is, and he's one of the group. So she has looked at photographs that are around the house and is displaying them above the mantelpiece, which really gives them a kind of pathos that's very moving.
That's really all about private familial emotions and special moments, isn't it?
I guess it is, and yet it's seeing other people's, because it's not hers. Mm. So the person who made the film, it's not about her moments, it's about looking at somebody else's moments.
Looking at someone else's moments, I was going to say, the technology requirements for this seem to be quite complicated, and is it quite expensive, and where do you get it all from?
Well, we've all managed to get our own projectors by now, but it's been building up slowly. And for instance, with my piece, I've got wireless headphones, but I've actually borrowed them for the occasion. Mm. I haven't bought them. Mm. I think I might be tempted now, because they're so exciting to use.
Tell me about this piece, because one goes up the stairs in the house and you can see a film being projected askance sideways on the stairwell, and then your piece is in the top front bedroom. One part showing inside a picture frame and another part on a wall. I see that there's somebody apparently writing a diary in it, and then these paintings which have an interesting, well, the drawings that have a very interesting story behind them. Can you tell me what that's all about?
Well, this is Ernie's house, and that is the place where he works, and it's his bedroom. But it's also got his desk in. So it was very interesting that he and I are both presenting our work in the same space, which overlap. And it's about how we both think about what NERF does for us. So he's actually writing and thinking about what NERF is and in my piece. And then I'm projecting that onto my hands, and I'm writing it with my voice. And then you get my voice in your right ear and his voice in your left ear, slowly revealing what NERF means to us, NERF, the film group. But his piece in the corner then is about his brother's life and his brother's work, which he's researching at the moment, which is a very moving story.
The host for this month's event was artist Ernie Dalton, whose house is in Brunswick Terrace.
Are you an artist yourself?
Well, I was a playwright and a performer in my 20s and 30s, and then I went into having a family and doing other kinds of things to make money, mainly teaching in medical schools, actually.
You've given over your house to a group of, well, there were nine, but again, there's eight artists in this
particular... Yeah, even though Nerf is seven, which is, you know, ironic.
And basically your house has been looked at by the artists, and they've looked at all the spaces in it, and then they've looked at your life, and then they've decided that they're going to reinterpret the things that they saw and create these wonderful films. Are you surprised at the result?
Well, it's much better as art than as life.
In the upstairs bedroom, there's that rather interesting two-screen show there with a soundtrack that one listens to through headphones. But that tells a rather heart-wrenching story about your brother's life, doesn't it? The drawings.
Well, my brother is an artist and has been doing a series of drawings. He's always been interested in the context of following a line. It's a kind of key artistic kind of attention and fascination. And the subject of it was that he had an experience where his wife had a serious car crash some decades ago, and he spent most of his time caring for her, at the same time conducting experiments in drawing, because, you know, he'd been an artist in his younger life, and he returned to it with a rather powerful investigation of contemplation and discovery through art, which is extraordinary.
1,500 drawings. That's quite a fantastic record, isn't it?
It is, and I always was amazed at how much attention he needed to both pay to the art as well as taking care of his wife. I mean, and he was distracted from neither. This is a great tribute to him, really.
It's the joy of holding an event like this that everybody is completely surprised about what actually happens in the end. I mean, you've got the idea of this collaboration, you've got the basic concept by it, and then everyone goes off and does their thing, and then when it actually happens, it's all a bit of a surprise to everybody who's involved in, you know, what it generates.
I mean, and it's been a fantastic for me personally, creatively, over the last few years to be a member of NERTH. I think we've got something quite unique in terms of collaboration as a group of individual artists who come together and get inspired and connected through the work and processes of how we make films. I think showing it in our home spaces, I mean, partly it was a practical thing because we didn't want to go in some of those sterile kind of gallery type places, so in a sense it follows through the kind of level of, I think, depth of connection we've made with each other, I think, and bringing the works together is always fantastically interesting. You know, I get really excited and it's a surprise to me. I don't know how you found it.
And it's fantastically interesting.
Well, I think, and also if you've talked to the other artists, they come from different artistic disciplines, they do different things, but what we bring together as NERTH is we focus on film, and I think film's a major issue, because we're surrounded by film all the time, especially nowadays with the internet. Everything seems to have a surface, whereas I think what we do is that we use the surface as a beginning.
That's right, you've turned it all on its head by projecting things on ceilings and stairwells.
And I think it works, actually. Even in a really modest small house like this, I think it shows you that you don't have to be confined to sitting in front of the goggle box as the only way to receive information or be glued to the computer. I mean, there's actually a dynamism about film which doesn't need to be contained in a black box. And so that's what we've done well with.
Filmmaker Trish McRae took over the garden space to show her piece on the experience of upping stumps and moving from Cambridge to France.
As an artist, what do you normally work with? Are you a painter or a sculptor?
I started off with painting, drawing, sculpture, wood carving, like for 10 years. But then my studio space was gone. I couldn't use my studio anymore, so I had to find some way of expressing myself, and I moved into film. And I just immediately took off with it. It was fantastic. I really, really loved the whole sort of medium. It's really, really exciting.
Now we're standing in the back garden here at Brunswick Terrace, and you put a large sheet up on the wall, and you're projecting your film on it. Everyone seems to be enjoying it very much. Tell me what's in the film and what's it about.
Well, every year NERTH do a response to a domestic setting, and this year I've moved to France, so I felt I didn't belong here. I felt that I wanted to be outside, you know, sort of not in the hub of the house. But so I've responded to the journey from my house to Ernie's house. Yeah. And it sort of relates to my journey from Cambridge to France as well. So I've used Beckett's End Game as sort of dialogue running through the film. Mm. And it's, you know, it's quite emotional for me, really, because it's about abandoning things, you know, yeah, people and friends and children and everything, you know. So it's about loss, really.
A very visually interesting film, because you've got lots of different things in there, some things you'd recognise and some things that are completely sort of abstract and weird. Is it all about basically information overload or hectic things going on in your life?
All of the footage is literally me putting the camera against the window and driving over. So it's footage of motion of me driving through.
And what's going on in the heart and mind?
Exactly. I mean, I've highly manipulated it. So I am an editor, really. Mostly I'm an editor, so I like changing colour and using filters to, you know, enhance footage and stuff like that. And I'm a big sound guy, so I like to have interesting sounds, diegetic and non-diegetic, you know, to enhance the whole thing.
It's going around in a loop of what, about 8 or 10 minutes or so?
Five minutes.
So how long does it take you to create a piece like that?
Oh my god. Yeah, I mean, I can make a film, you know, it's hours and hours and hours of editing. Absolutely hours. Yeah. I mean, I spend a long time doing it. Frame by frame.
Fantastic effect. It's also interesting to be standing outside on a winter night in warm coats with a glass and watching a film in the garden. It's sort of slightly surreal,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were hugely into the non-Hollywood, experience. We don't want to sit back and enjoy the ride. Yeah. We want people to get up and feel, you know, and participate and, you know, be involved in the viewing and wonder and let our own the viewers' thoughts sort of go into the film and wonder what the hell it's all about, you know. So you're not a sit back and enjoy the ride. You're constantly thinking, what the hell's going on here? And it's, you know, physical, you know, it's spatial, it's sensual, it's, you know, it's everything. So it's not Hollywood.
An absolutely super a super event to come to. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sally Todd, an artist who works with the Royal Opera House, produced a film rotating on a turntable in the middle of the living room so that the screen area moves around the walls in a circle.
I made a film in the round several years ago, which was Super 8 old film technology of the game of Blind Man's Buff with a figure rotating in space, which seemed to fit with the subject matter. And when I came into Ernie's house and wanted to use the dining room because it spoke to me in some way, I found the very squareness of it lent itself to that idea again about the parlour game, this sort of stifled box-shaped scale room, and I wanted to make a film that would somehow liberate and escape from its dimensions. So I suppose it was a sense of like disorientation, orientating the domestic space and using the notion of a game in the content of the film, this sort of restrained idea of the parlour game that's very ordered and, you know, Sunday innocent, but
you work as a puppeteer, haven't you?
Well, I do. I work as an artist in a theatre company. I have a theatre company with my partner. Yeah, so I work. I sort of do a lot of animating and materials. We do work with puppetry as well. It's mainly shadow puppetry and images.
Very interesting. And what kind of reaction do you get from people to this?
I think it's quite a challenge to the audience because at first they feel like they have to follow physically the film in the space, but I think hopefully the sound and the narrative within the film grounds them so that they don't necessarily need to see and follow the whole image. But I think it's about where they position themselves in relation to the film. It's for them to actually respond.
What's the scope of what this film covers?
It's playing with the notion of what's in the space. It's using the physical trappings of what's there in the room to begin with. But then I've looped it and also used other layers of film that have revolved as well. So I'm using revolving film. It's quite complex, and earlier bits of footage about domestic objects that are layered into this actual room now that we're sitting in.
Sally Todd, a fantastically interesting piece. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Other artists in the group include Helen Judge, Steve Russell, Susanna Jeselek and Helena Green. You may have possibly been taking advantage of the myriad of wonderful events on offer during the recent Festival of Ideas, and there's been much to discover across the city. Artist Gulnar Malik invited me to meet a group of 6 painters exhibiting in the foyer of West Road Concert Hall to complement a stage performance of contemporary music and dance from the Cambridge Shannon May Centre. Other artists included Sama Sultani, Hamid Reza Gelishchani, Sergei Fyefanov, Veronika Szymanowska, and Faruza Melville, all who worked on art specifically connected to the play Zahak, Dragon King of Persia. So why did both paintings and play attract historians from far afield concerned with the art and folklore of the ancient Silk Route across from the East? Well, University of Cambridge Professor of Persian History Charles Melville initiated me into the Shahnameh, the ancient Persian Book of Kings. Shahnameh,
yeah.
Tales of over 1,000 years ago. What's it all about? What is this text?
Well, it's a lot of stories joined together, essentially, of the kings of ancient Iran, going back long before the historical period. I mean, the sort of myth of creation and the beginning of the world and the first man and the first king and the organization of society. And then we have a whole load of sort of dramatic stories which are illustrating, you know, how the world gets divided up, how Iran forms, it has its enemies on its left and its right, and so lots of battles. You know, it's a sort of a parable, really, of Iranian history as imagined over the centuries.
So this was passed down through the generations,
yeah.
As folklore, as music, as myths and legends?
Yeah, probably not so much as music at the time. I mean, it was orally recited, though. It's quite definite that there were readers, because most of the population was illiterate, of course, so this thing would be recited in the equivalent of cafes, palaces, that we know the ruler often had someone reading the Shahnameh at bedtime, as it were, you know, and nice stories.
What are some of the classic features of those stories? What kind of things happen in
them? Well, there's a lot of emphasis on loyalty. A lot of the stories revolve around kingship, of course, because it's a book of kings. And one of the problems is, it's all right being loyal to a good king, but what if the king isn't good? What do you have to do? So this is, in other words, a sort of exemplary model for the subjects obeying the rulers, even if they're no good. But on the other hand, in the end, a bad ruler gets his comeuppance. So it's a sort of ethics of, you know, political ethics in a way. I mean, there's a lot of advice. It's like a mirror for princes, you know, how rulers should behave, what happens if they don't, what the subjects have to do, like the compact.
Look, these are timeless dilemmas and situations that people come across again and again and again.
Exactly. Yes, this is why it's such a great thing. It happens to be the Iranian version of many of these universal themes. And in there are a whole load of stories which are sort of recognisable, you know, like Cain and Abel, two brothers murdering their brother. I mean, you've got a lot of human experience and political. There's a lot of emphasis on loyalty. There's a lot of emphasis on wisdom and not acting rashly, you know, thinking, not being violent, and, you know, things that you'd expect.
What do we come to?
Well, we come to see tonight. This is one of the most dramatic stories because this is the first real tyrant, Zahak. Again, it's a bit like poor old Dr. Faustus or someone, or anyone, you know, anyone who is seduced by the devil. Basically, he murders his father, or Macbeth. I mean, you know, they're just different cultures, but the same story. And he essentially is, the devil comes and says, wouldn't it be nice if you were king? And you're only going to be king if you murder the old man. And he says, yeah, good idea. And he murders his father, and he inherits his kingdom. And then he becomes king of Iran. He's welcomed as king of Iran. But then he starts, the devil comes back and says, you know, I'll show you a few nice things, and then he gets, the reward is to kiss the tyrant. He just, all I want to do is kiss your shoulders, and when he kisses the shoulders, these two great snakes come out. And of course, this is a terrifying and horrible thing, but he's sold his soul, basically, you see, that's the problem. And so he then has to feed these snakes. So he's a tyrant, and he has to feed the snakes on the brains of young Iranian boys. Basically, and someone in the end, why it's so important, it's partly because it's a story of tyranny, but it's important because in the end the people rise up against it. So again, it's a sort of a model, and he's kicked out. and the rightful king returns, and then it's a happiness and light again for a bit. So it's the first time that really you get this dilemma. And of course, he's a sort of horrible creature in a way, but he's also an object of sympathy. And I think this is what Hussein, the composer, is really exploring the different readings of.
And you brought together this group of six artists.
Well, it's actually mainly my wife who's done that. Mm. I've been running this research project for years on the Shahnameh. It was mainly about the text of the epic and the paintings used to illustrate it in the manuscripts. Mm. But we're really trying to move beyond that to show how the poem is still relevant today. You know, modern Iranian composers are writing operas and ballets about it. You know, people writing poems, artists are doing paintings inspired by the stories. So in other words, it's not just a fantastic poem written 1,000 years ago. It's something that still means something, and it means different, you know, obviously different things. So that's the idea, is to show how it's still relevant, if you like, today, and has some...
Charles Melville, thank you very much indeed.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Great. Golnar, there's a very interesting set of paintings here in West Road Concert Hall in the reception area. Six artists, I gather, all together. You're taking tales that are 1,000 years old, and then you're working them into your paintings. Tell me a little bit about those. How did they come about?
Yes, you know, Charles Merville and Firuze's wife have compiled this wonderful database of 800 years of illustrations of Shahnameh. And that was a great inspiration for me. I was looking in the research engine for my name because I wanted to figure out what was the root of Lord Byron's Golnar. And I found it in the Shahnameh, and I found all of these wonderful illustrations. And for me, it was quite revealing to see this thread. And also, my mother has been painting the Shahnameh from the beginning, when it's about the Stone Age man. So I kind of had this background, as everybody in my nationality kind of. I am completely Persian. Mm. My parents are both from Shiraz, which is the Persian bit of Iran. Mm. I was first in Cambridge in 2006. Mm. So for me, Cambridge was self-discovery as much as everything else that I've got here. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them. But I am very interested in strong characters, especially if they are female. Because in contemporary Iran, I've seen so many of them that are less documented. And I don't see any of those wonderful, you know, typical Persian women who stand up for themselves. You don't see them in literature. And when you do, like you do in Shahnameh, it is very much less so present. Nobody has heard of Golnar. Everybody is talking about other characters like Sudoba and Tahmina and such, who already had a status. They were princesses and they just did whatever they wanted to do. But nobody is looking at a slave who actually stood up for herself. This is the situation here in Iran. So for me, it is more to bring light into the darkness.
Is Cleopatra a figure of great interest to you?
Yes, she was, actually. I love the Hollywood movies as well, I must confess.
I mean, looking for powerful women figures from ancient history is quite an interesting thing to do, because obviously they would never have been written up properly if they did exist or what have you. So going into that, it looks like an interesting departure. I mean, do you talk a lot to historians and people like that?
Actually, we had a talk on Saturday for the Festival of Ideas that historians like Charles also... we're making the event going, and we just added our paintings to it. But, you know, tonight, it is as much about a strong woman like Golnar as it is about Zahak, which is, you know, it's opposite situation, both in terms of him being a man And in terms of him being a demon who goes darker and darker rather than a woman.
Can we go into the individual tales of the three paintings which you've got on display here? Because they're all very interesting. The one where you have the woman who's climbing into the room of somebody else. What's the story behind that? Because she was a person who was given great responsibility and then possibly abused it, or what have you.
She knew her place, because in the end she chose to remain a slave, and I think that is her strength.
Can you tell me the story from the beginning there?
There was a king called Ardavan. He was the last king of the Ashkani dynasty. And this is a period in Iranian history that there were many different powers around, and one of them was a person called Ardashir, who came to the king's palace as a guest. And Gulnar, who was a slave, but also a favorite of the king, who was trusted with the treasury, saw him from the window and instantly fell in love with him. So she climbed his chamber with a rope, and she built up this courage of risking everything she had. You know, she wouldn't have survived if she'd been, you know, summoned. And into the darkness of taking the risk whether this man wants her or not, or, you know, what happens next. And as you see, this picture looks at the contrast of the light, the darkness, the mystery. And also it looks at the history behind it as well. So the archway on the bottom is a Sassanid archway. It's a famous one. It's called Tara Castro, which still remains. And the upper archway is an Ashkanid archway that shows the last dynasty, and she climbing from one to the other. And also the perspective shows that this is timeless. People who stand up for themselves and take a risk. And, you know, it's not about being right or wrong or about being good or bad. It is about the ability to stand up and make a decision for yourself.
You've lit that very interestingly from the back, because you have a light behind it as well. What is that supposed to add to? I mean, it makes the picture light up from behind, but what was the purpose of doing that?
It lightens up the detailing of the Ashkanid archway. Yeah. It's the present. It is the light. It is the known. Whereas the Sassanid archway, which is not lit and it's plain, it is what she knows about. It is what she doesn't know about, and this is the darkness she's climbing into. And also the light that you see is shining through the torn bit of canvas that is covered with epoxy resin, that you see the kind of, you know, it is a dreamlike notion of who is lying down below. And it is light because it is love.
So it's capturing a timeless truth and experience, a human experience, really, from a long, long time ago that would probably be exactly the same if someone did it today.
Yeah, that's true.
And then the other two, you have this figure who was the devil's cook. Tell me about that one.
He was the king's... He became the king because he killed his father, who was the king. And he was a demon from the beginning, but Satan took interest in him. So he made himself into a cook-looking person, and started cooking meat dishes for the first time in human history, as the book says. And then he was so fond of the cuisine that he told Satan, "So, how am I going to reward you for all this?" And he said, "Oh, kingship, could you please let me kiss your shoulders?" So he was possessed by snakes, and two snakes grew from his shoulders, and no matter what he did, they would grow back. So it is a kind of, it is mythical, but there is also some realistic kind of contemporary notions of it that interests me, because in the Far Eastern ideology, there is things such as being possessed by a snake.
And the two women involved, how did they come to be in the
Yes, well, so when he took Persia over, as well, he was an Arab, and he invaded Persia, and the king had two daughters, so he he just made them to become witches for him, and they were like under his wing until Feridun set them free later on in the story. But this picture shows Zahak being enthroned, and he's in a framework in there because he's got his boundaries, despite the fact that he's trying to break it. He's trying to make everything black for 1,000 years. But he's got also his boundaries, and also you can see the boundaries and the kind of composition that I've used in older Persian illustrations, which go back to 800 years. My favorite bit is the two mirrors that show the self-deceit, the way he has to confront himself at some point. And also that also has a reference to the compositions in miniatures, that they're quite empowering, and you just sometimes happen to miss the point because all of these ornamentations are like juxtapositioned into the painting.
They're wonderfully colourful paintings, and obviously quite a lot of them are in relief with wonderful aesthetics, and they're very mysterious as well. This one is about a bird. Can you tell me about this this mythical bird figure and how that came about?
Yes, well, this mythical bird is called Simor. She was wonderfully elaborate. And she gave birth to Rustam. And Rustam is a hero in Shahnameh, and very much like Achilles, he's got a very long tail of winning over competitors. And he's so big that his mother is not able to give birth to him. So Seymour comes and gives her a C-section 4,000 years ago. And then, so Rustam arrives and she takes care of him afterwards. So she nurtures a human being. And then when he's grown up and he's gone off, she gives him a piece of her feather. And whenever he needed her, he would burn it and she would show up. So this image shows the magic of salvation, of how probably Rustam would have felt with her encounter. It's the uplifting, it's the powerful, it is the feminine also.
Golnar Eros, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Simon.
The mother of Golnar, who's Iranian, was fascinated by the epic of the Shahnameh, as she herself is concerned with creative milieu both in life and fiction. Her work features powerful female figures from Iranian myth and history, centering on Islam, which she says has always severely restricted women's activities. She explores breaking rules as a timeless requirement, and ideas of freedom of expression and tradition in real history. Capturing timeless truths in humanity expressed in the Shahnameh tales, such as lovers climbing through windows and other classic real-life situations, inspired her work. The Shahnameh tales cover themes of power play, embezzlement, elopement, and risking it all for love. A new contemporary Cambridge choir dedicated to bringing choral music into the 21st century, and quite gloriously, I can promise, has just launched its long-awaited first CD ahead of performances this coming week. Conkalenda Choir, which seeks to play modern music with more visually exciting stage performance, began life amongst music scholars in Cambridge over a year ago under the directorship of Alexandra Schwinn, a 23-year-old choral scholar from America currently at Jesus College, who initially founded the group at Sydney Sussex College Chapel to fully exploit its marvellous acoustics. She dropped into 105 to tell us about it.
Here I am with a very special person in the 105 studios, Alexandra Schwinn. You are the director of a fantastic contemporary choir, which I sampled some 6 or 8 months ago in Sydney Sussex College Chapel. It was, for me, a fantastic experience listening to your choir. You've just launched a CD. Can you tell me about what's on it?
Sure. It's all living British composers. There's a pick mix of 7 different composers, 13 tracks. We've got a couple of tracks by Paul Millar and Jonathan Dove, Gabrielle Jackson, Alexander Kamkin did a commission, so did Andrew Cusworth, Alex Patterson.
Are you performing at the moment in conjunction with the launch of the CD?
We are. We have a concert on Thursday the 21st in St. Giles Church in Cambridge, which is really exciting, which will be our CD launch concert, but will also act as sort of a Christmas concert.
I saw last time I saw you, I dropped in to see you in the Sydney Sussex College chapel, and you were all working intensely towards this. Since then, you've had a number of performances, haven't you? How have they all gone, and what's happened with the choir? Is there any stories you can tell me about it?
I mean, it's been an exciting few months since I last saw you, to say the least. We've had just one other concert since then, but lots of projects, recordings, things like that have all been released and things. So we had our music video that was released in July, and then we had a remix competition in September that was released in October with our debut single. The album obviously came out today, so there will be lots of promotions and videos to go along with that. We'll be having the concert on Thursday, which will be filmed, and then we'll have releases for our, we're going to launch a live section on our YouTube channel of us doing things live, and then there are a couple of other video projects that are in the works, including composer profiles and kind of scratch videos of us performing around different places.
For you, you're the kingpin of the whole operation as the choir director. I know that you work very, very hard because I've seen you doing that. How does it feel for you to have got this project from the starting point right up to the point where you're launching CDs and giving all of these performances, which are obviously thrilling people to bits?
Well, it's been very exciting. I think my biggest excitement about all of the launches is that I've had all of this stuff in the works for the last year, and I kind of feel like we've been building and building and building but haven't really been able to show the world anything yet. And now that we've built up a social media stance with Facebook and Twitter and everything, we're able to kind of, now I'm able to say, this is actually the sound that we have, and, you know, world, check out Concanenta. Whereas before, it was kind of me saying that we were going to do things, but not many people having actually heard anything that the choir had done. So
You were also planning to do some performances in London, weren't you, at some point? Is that coming up? Or?
Well, we have some projects that are in the work, planning works for 2014, but nothing's been officially announced yet, so... Yeah.
Concanenta, I can vouch for them because I've been to one of their rehearsals. Absolutely fantastic stuff. Let's play a tune.
Looking at a past experience or perhaps a well-known place in retrospect can play interesting tricks on the mind and memory, especially if it's a place or thing that you love. A new exhibition has just opened by Cambridge artist Gail de Cordova at Clare Hall Gallery, which runs until December the 18th and is open daily, and it's well worth the bike ride, as I discovered. Gail works with oil, plaster and tissue paper on acrylics to create suggested landscapes based on the memory of places she loves. Drawing on a rugged Cornish childhood and travels in Spain, she produces landscapes that touch off the imagination and do wonderful things to you in terms of their pleasing aesthetics. She gave me a brief introduction to the work.
Gail, tell me a little bit about your past. What's your background and how did you come to be an artist?
I've actually trained many years ago as a fine artist. I took a degree in painting at Exeter College of Art and Design. Mm. 1981 I graduated and I've actually been painting ever since. So.
Is this latest collection all new work that you're showing here at the moment?
This is mostly done in the last year to year and a half, with one or two of the larger works being older, but not much older.
and they're basically quite a collection of what you might describe as landscapes, but they're a little bit different from landscapes, aren't they? What is it about your paintings? What do you try to do?
Well, they're kind of inner landscapes, I think, but they're memory and places that have meant a lot to me, and I've sort of, they're almost been distilled over time. You see, I don't go somewhere, paint it. I might make some drawings, but what happens is over time and memory, I create them later on.
We're standing in front of a fantastic blue canvas. It's very, very bright, like a beautiful remembered place. It's a cove, isn't it, in Cornwall? But it's not as the cove as a landscape. It's as you remember something that you love, as a kind of abstract kind of thing as well in the landscape.
That's right.
Tell me about this, because there's a story behind this painting that's interesting.
Well, yes, this is painting really from my memory of Prussia Cove, which is where I grew up. Mm. And it's a very amazing place, actually, and it's got this wonderful history. The King of Prussia, who was a pirate, who was a local known character at the time. And for me, I suppose it's the texture and the sensation and that kind of deep connection I have with the place. Mm-hmm. And I sort of don't paint it for a while, and then it just comes again and I have to paint it.
Mm. There are some really wild and remote big beaches, aren't there, in Cornwall, in places that you, especially in winter, you get these fantastically big seas, massive rock outcrops and cliffs and things like that. And it's all about getting that sort of ruggedness, isn't it?
I do. I never think of Cornwall as this cosy, sort of cute little place. It's a very raw kind of energy that you get there. And the elements, you're very aware of that, and as you said, these granite cliffs, and there's quite a drama.
do you seek to touch off memories of places in your work? Because they're not graphic landscapes. They're almost half remembered, half imagined as well, aren't they?
That's right. Mm. That's right. The sort of dream comes in as well, and that comes into play.
Mm. And
No, I was going to say, so in a sense they're very different, because it's going to be my memory, my perception of somewhere.
Mm. And also you're building up some of these with things on the inside. You're describing earlier about how you build up a relief in your paintings by putting them on the floor. How does that process work?
Yes, I start. It's always like a prayer, because I sort of kneel and then I actually move around the canvas. Mm. It lies on the floor because some of the materials I'm using, like the plaster that I use and some very watery materials, would just slide off if I was painting them conventionally. Mm. But there's a point at which I do turn it up and decide, well, that's the top, that's the bottom, and I carry on painting it.
Mm. And those aesthetics, giving some parts of the painting in relief and others at the back, it gives you a sense of nearness and farness and distance and perspective. That's an interesting way of working. Did you just come across that, or did you think about that very carefully before you did it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in a different way of creating the space, and I love the Japanese prints, for example, and how they create some kind of space, but it's all very flat. Mm. And with me, obviously, there's all the texture in there, and then the flat is the sort of almost watery underneath bits, you know, with the almost like watercolour, but it's...
How many paintings have you got here at the...
I've got 46.
Watermelon and Sunset.
Yeah.
How would you describe that yourself?
well, that's kind of got this sort of lusciousness of eating a watermelon for me, and these almost like seeds here, mm-hmm. and the colour as well, and the sunset, very reminiscent of a Spanish sunset, which has that terrific sort of orangey red, and there's even some gold in there, so yeah, that's a kind of sensual.
And you've travelled quite a bit in Spain and Portugal, have you?
I've lived in Spain, and my children are actually from Spain, and my ancestors are from Cordoba, hence my name.
So you had a Cornish childhood and then adventures in Spain as well. And what were your influences as an artist? What kind of affected your choices, as it were?
All kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've just recently been to that Paul Clay exhibition in London, and he's a terrific... great influence, as are the Spanish artists, people like Antoni Tàpies with all the textures, and some of the Renaissance masters as well, so lots of different...
How long will this show be going on for?
And this goes on to the 18th of December.
The 18th of December, so people have got lots and lots of time to come and look at this exhibition.
Yes, I hope they come.
So imagination and memory are very important to you then. It's sort of reflecting on what you've experienced and then creating art from that.
That's right. Yeah. Even with Katerina's pots, my neighbour Katerina Klug, the potter, they're not literally her pots, but somehow they've got into my system, and so there are elements of her pots that will crop up.
Mm. And how do you want people to look at these? What do you want them to take away from?
Well, I like people to bring their own imaginations to play. You know, I like them to look at it, and then perhaps there's a place that they can identify with. And that often happens. I had an exhibition in Sweden, and people were saying, coming up to me and saying, this is the north of Sweden, this is how it is, and I've never been there. So that excites me.
Gail, what a fantastically spectacular group of paintings, really.
Thank you very much.
The word home means something markedly different to each and every one of us, and that simple theme has recently been centre of an international short story competition run by Cambridge-based Askance Publishing. Homes, the Askance 2004 short story collection, is an anthology of 19 competition finalists, and each one has a unique and peculiar slant and angle, which the Askance brand prides itself in looking for. At the book launch at Charity of the Year Emmaus, I spoke to Askance Publishing's Caroline Jane, first prize-winning author Margaret Loach, and book cover fine artist Jane Fisher.
How diverse were the stories that were actually entered into the competition?
Incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
We were anticipating there might be lots of depressing stories about homelessness, but in fact they were hugely diverse. There were stories, Margaret's story, which was the winner, was told from the point of view of a house. There were stories from all over the world about journeys, about the spiritual sense of home as well as the physical.
And does it sort of turn your assumptions about what goes on in other people's homes, as it were, or notions of home that are different from what you might expect at all?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Not only do the stories acknowledge the difference in people's feeling of what the word homes means, but working with Emmaus in Cambridge, I've come to understand how diverse homeless people are and the paths that have led them to homelessness.
With the connection with Emmaus, were there entries from people who actually work or live and work in the Emmaus community that are publishing?
There were, I'm really pleased to say that the book opens with quite an experimental piece of writing by one of Emmaus's companions.
Margaret, tell me about your work, because your piece actually won.
My short story is called Abandon, and it's set in the town that I grew up in, partly, in the United States of America, just outside of Chicago, really. And it's a story that is told from the perspective of a house, so the narrator is a house. It's a house that is an old mansion from the days of sort of the giant car manufacturing plants in that part of the States. And the house is in disrepair and is really falling apart. And it's about how the house is in feeling about that, and feeling about a man who comes along who wants to renovate it. And the house is at odds, really, with the man's plans.
So there's a kind of genus loci in the house with its past and its past story, and someone comes to change that. Is that what happens?
A little bit. I think the house has a feeling of this sort of the organic nature, the world around taking the house over, so sort of giant molds growing in the kitchen and the walls crumbling and the mice and the raccoons in the attic and that sort of thing. So the house also has an occupant, a man, a homeless man, who is living in a cupboard in the attic during the winter months. So the story really does
does a play with this idea of home and what home means. So on the one side you have the home itself and how it feels about being a house and its history of the sort of grandeur and what it's become and what it's becoming, and also the idea of home from a homeless person's perspective and the idea of home from the man who wants to renovate the house and bring it back to its state of grandeur, basically.
And how do you feel about being the winning entry?
I'm most excited. I'm really, really pleased. I've been writing short stories for a couple of years now, and this is the sort of most success I've received. So I'm really, really delighted, and it's wonderful to be part of this publication, part of Askance, part of Emmaus. It's just very wonderful, yeah.
That sounds like an absolutely fascinating story. Now, Jane, you did the actual illustration for the book, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that? How did your idea develop?
Well, I'm just finishing off my fine art degree. At the moment in Colchester, and I've been working with found photographs, found transparencies, and it's just something I've been working on, to layering up, and the cover is a kind of projection which also involves, as it turns out, a wooden crate, and I just thought the image worked with the theme when I saw the poster for the competition.
You must be very pleased with the way it's turned out.
Very pleased, yeah.
What a super project. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time to take a brief glimpse of what's coming up in the city in the next few weeks, some of which will be out of date if you're listening to the rerun of this programme in early December. If you fancy a bit of atmosphere, the Four Seasons by Candlelight with the Mozart Festival Orchestra in 18th century costume performs at the Corn Exchange on December the 3rd. And there's an evening of burlesque on Saturday, December the 7th at the same venue. A new exhibition has opened at Kettle's Yard Gallery, featuring the house and collection of Victor Skip, a legacy of extraordinary art objects, primitive art, modernism, philosophy and literature. Pantomime Robin Hood opens at the Arts Theatre on December the 5th. Kenny Wax Limited's What the Ladybird Heard, based on the award-winning picture book, opens at the Corn Exchange on the 11th of December. And the Fairhaven Singers concert season with conductor Ralph Woodward features performances at Jesus College Chapel on the 7th and 8th of December, including work by Benjamin Britten and Gabrielli as music of Advent and Christmas. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105 Community Radio. I'm Simon Burton, and if you have an art story to tell, send us an email.